Hi, I'm Lorraine Rapp.
And I'm Linda Lowen.
Welcome to Take Care, a weekly conversation on health and wellness produced by WRVO Public Media. On today's show, you've heard it since you were a kid, candy rots your teeth. But with Halloween so close, you probably have candy in your house already that you're testing to make sure is okay to hand out. Why does sugar cause tooth decay? And what can you do to avoid getting cavities? We'll talk with a dentist from the Mayo Clinic.
But first, in the weeks leading up to Halloween, millions of people pay good money to see bad things happen. Chainsaw massacres, haunted houses, spooky hayrides. These experiences elicit fear, an emotion many of us crave. Why are horror films and Stephen King novels so popular? What's going on inside our brains that allows fictional fear and terror to be entertaining?
At the same time, debilitating, paralyzing fear of specific real-life situations like fear of flying, public speaking, and claustrophobia affect as many as 18% of American adults. Treating and reducing fear may be possible, but it takes work. Joining us for a discussion of fear and the brain is Dr. Elizabeth Phelps of New York University. Dr. Phelps is a professor in NYU's Department of Psychology and Center for Neural Science, and director of the Phelps Lab, which examines the cognitive neuroscience of emotion, learning, and memory. Welcome to Take Care, Dr. Phelps. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Halloween is right around the corner, and you can see some scary decorations are already out and surrounding us. We'd like to understand from all the research that you've done and have read about, why do some people find being scared out of their wits fun and entertaining? What's going on in their brain?
Well, so let's just, I just want to start by saying, you know, I don't know any data that actually looks at sort of fake fear, which is what we're talking about, right? Having said that, I mean, I can speculate. So what we do know is, you know, if you're watching a scary movie, let's use that as the example, the physiological responses you have are pretty much identical to what you'll have if you're actually being threatened, but you're not being threatened, right? Human adults have the ability to simulate things in their mind and create a good portion of the same biological responses you'd have as if it was happening in the real world, but there is some part of you that knows the difference. So nobody really likes to feel like they have their life threatened, but there is something that's a little fun for some people about sort of simulating it in a, you know, in a make-believe sort of way. Children, of course, are not so good at separating what's, you know, make-believe versus not, so you may think twice about taking your kid to one of those movies. But the reasons why some individuals like that is not something that there's a lot of scientific research on, in part because, you know, we're more concerned with things like trying to actually deal with people that have fear disorders. But there is some speculation. So there, it is the case that some individuals like thrills more than others, and that some individuals seem to have a need to have a little bit more arousal in their lives than others. And so they go on things like, you know, roller coasters and the like. Riding motorcycles, and it may be the case that this is just another way to get some arousal in your life, is watching a scary movie, knowing that it's safe.
Yes, we are going to talk about real fear in people's lives in the form of phobias, but I just want to stay with this subject. I wondered myself, because I think of activities like reading thrillers and watching horror movies in one category. I wondered if it did trigger the same response as more active forms where people are doing downhill skiing or bungee jumping or, you know, going on roller coasters. Would you say, just from your observation, that that's pretty much one group?
It is the case, you know, the sort of autonomic response you get to excitement and fear are relatively the same, right? So your heart rate goes up, your pupils dilate, and you start to sweat a little bit. These are all pretty much the same, and it doesn't really matter what triggers it. It's just getting you ready for responding. So, you know, there is an element in fear in extreme skiing, right? There's a threat there to your physical health as well as the excitement. And we know from our laboratory studies, so when we do fear studies in the laboratory, we activate all the same brain systems you see involved in a rat that really is in a, they think they're in a life-threatening situation. The rat does. We can't do that in the laboratory. But it tells us that, you know, these simulated fears do activate those same brain circuits.
I was reading about a possible genetic component that might predispose some people to that, to thrill-seeking. Have you found that?
We haven't looked at that, no. I mean, there is evidence that there's a lot of individual variability in thrill-seeking, and obviously one of the reasons for individual variability is genetic differences. It's not the only reason, but you might expect that would be the case.
One final question before we move on to real fear versus fake fear, as you described it. Do you think that this is perhaps a more recent development? In other words, we are no longer exposed to the types of dangers that we have been, I guess you could say, conditioned by centuries to respond to. And lacking that, is that where that desire for that arousal comes from?
You know, that's really hard to say. I think we've gotten better at simulating fears with our technology, right, by sort of removing ourselves from actual danger. Now, you know, if we were living in an environment where there was actual danger, does that mean we still wouldn't have some enjoyment of simulated fear where we know we're actually safe? I don't know if that's the case. But I think, you know, I think, so it's hard to say, you know, you're asking me, is there a trade-off? Now that we don't actually have threats to our survival very much, are we seeking that out? And that's possible, but, you know, it'd be hard to say scientifically that's the case.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Dr. Elizabeth Phelps. She's the director of the Phelps Lab at NYU and a professor in the Department of Psychology and Center for Neural Science. She studies the interactions between learning, emotion, and the human brain. This is Take Care. I'm Lorraine Rapp.
And I'm Linda Lowen.
Let's segue, if we can, to people that really do experience really debilitating fear in their everyday life in the form of phobias. Mm-hmm. What has science told us as this is being more studied? Why are some people more prone to develop these types of phobias? What's going on inside for them?
So, you know, so I think the question you're asking is really one of the more important questions is how come some people get these disorders and other people don't? And I would say in terms of science understanding, you know, why is someone vulnerable, someone's not, that's where we're really focusing our efforts today. And we don't have a lot of good answers. We know a lot more about how it works in the brain than why it might work differently in you than somebody else. Obviously, there's genetic factors. Obviously, there's experiential factors. But we aren't very good at this point at saying what exactly those factors are. So I could not identify somebody who has yet to develop a fear disorder that this person is going to be very likely to develop one and this person's not. And I think that's where the science has to go. We know more about sort of how fears come about. And we're learning more and more, and this is where I think the sort of the scientific breakthroughs are coming right now, about novel ways to help get rid of fears once you acquire them. And so that's always been what the clinicians try to do. Someone comes into the clinic, they have a fear disorder. How do we get rid of it? Previously, we said, you know, we just expose you to the thing you're afraid of, right? So this is just getting back on the horse. The part of the problem when you're really afraid of something is you never are around that thing because you avoid it, and therefore you never have the opportunity to learn that it's safe. And this we call sort of extinction or exposure learning. And if you came into the clinic with a phobia, they would treat you just like that. They would say, we know this terrifies you. You've been avoiding it forever, but we're going to make you confront it. And the act of confronting it and not having a bad consequence actually helps you confront it again.
What is it about somebody who suffers from a debilitating level of fear that it really compromises their choices in life? Is there something that's happening inside the brain that is different from someone who experiences a normal, tolerable level of fear?
Yes, absolutely. So part of the brain circuit, so there's really an interplay of brain circuits that are involved in both adaptively responding to fear and maladaptively responding to fear. So it makes sense for everybody to be afraid of something that's actually going to threaten your survival. The part of the problem in somebody with a fear disorder is, you know, what they don't do is now realize that, okay, in this circumstance, I'm not threatened. So, you know, everyone might be a little afraid of a snake if it's, you know, deadly, but if you're in a zoo and the snake's behind a glass, you know, you shouldn't be afraid, and most people aren't, right? If you have a phobia, you might not even be able to approach that snake, you know, see that snake, even if you know you're safe. We know that the brain circuits that are involved in sort of the generation of fears, the amygdala, but there's also the prefrontal cortex is very important in inhibiting the amygdala and sort of letting it, you know, in quieting the amygdala when there is no threat involved. And it's that circuit, the amygdala prefrontal cortex, and also the hippocampus tells you, like, this is a safe circumstance, this is not, those regions have to work together to adaptively respond to when there's real threat versus when you're not threatened. And in individuals who suffer from fear disorders, there's usually some dysfunction of that circuit, and you know, one component or another.
Now, you mentioned earlier that if somebody came into your lab with a phobia, they would be treated by kind of confronting the fear and desensitizing them to the point where it gets diminished. But you, right before that, had mentioned that you're looking into novel approaches to helping in that situation. Could you just describe what are some of these novel approaches?
Sure. So that's a great technique. It works pretty well. But now let's imagine you're stressed, right? So that requires the prefrontal cortex. It requires the prefrontal cortex to inhibit the amygdala. Stress makes the prefrontal cortex not work so well. So now you're stressed, you know, and all of a sudden, you know, you're less able to control that fear again. That's one reason why that's not great. So what these techniques do, where I bring you in and I expose you to the thing you're afraid of, they help you learn to inhibit the fear. They don't get rid of the fear itself. And so now the prefrontal cortex is impaired by stress and the fear comes back, you know, or just you're in a different place and the fear comes back, you know, so the fear is still there. The fear memory is still there, but but you're inhibiting it and that inhibition doesn't always work. And so the new techniques we're looking at are things where we're actually trying to alter the fear itself. We're doing this by taking advantage of the idea that when you retrieve a memory, the memory is a little sensitive or labile before you store it again. If we can target that stage, you know, where the memory is sort of going back into your brain after you've retrieved it, we can actually change the memory or perhaps disrupt the memory and therefore change the original fear itself as opposed to just inhibiting it. And so that there's a large body of research looking at this idea right now that maybe what we need to be targeting is not trying to enhance the circuit that inhibits the fear, but actually change the fear itself. This is sort of still science fiction, but it's active research, and I think in the next decade we'll see some exciting developments.
I was just going to ask you that about the link between fear and memory. We have about 30 seconds, but so you're saying that you believe that the future of fear containment is in working on memory?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, all of these things come from at some point learning, and so we need to target that learning. And then we might be able to change the fear.
Dr. Elizabeth Phelps is the director of the Phelps Lab at NYU and a professor in the Department of Psychology and Center for Neuroscience. She studies the interactions between learning, emotion, and the human brain. Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Phelps.
Thanks. Bye.
For more information on fear and the brain and Dr. Elizabeth Phelps, visit the Take Care webpage at wrvo.org/takecare. Podcasts of our show are available on iTunes and the WRVO website.
Coming up, back away from that bowl of Halloween candy. It'll rot your teeth. But if you do sneak a nibble, a Mayo Clinic dentist has the latest on avoiding tooth decay. You're listening to Take Care on WRVO Public Media.